Welcome to Bristol's Trail, charting the city's associations with the slave trade. The trail is adapted from the guide produced by Bristol Museums, Galleries and Archives. The trail starts on College Green. Please note, this first part involves walking up Park Street, which is a steep hill. You may prefer to proceed straight to part two, crossing the bottom of Park Street by the pedestrian crossing and entering Orchard Street. Part 1. The Georgian House. Walk from College Green up Park Street and turn left into Great George Street. Stop outside number 7, the Georgian House. The house is one of Bristol's museums and is open to the public from Saturday to Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The house was built and owned by John Pinney, who lived from 1740 to 1818. Pinney earned his fortune from his sugar plantations on the Caribbean island of Nevis, from where he returned in 1783. He then set up another sugar company with his friend James Tobin, who was actively involved against the campaign to abolish the slave trade. Together they owned ships and loaned money to plantation owners, taking over both the plantations and slaves of those who couldn't pay their debts. Pinney and his personal slave Perrow are the subject of an exhibition inside the house, which has been recreated as a typical Georgian house of the period. On his death, Pinney left £340,000, a huge fortune for the time. Retrace your steps to the corner house of Great George Street. This house was owned by Henry Kruger, who was born in New York but moved to England and became a member of the Merchant Venturers in Bristol. He was mayor in 1781 and later an MP. He married the daughter of banker Samuel Peach of Tockington. Peach, who was part owner of the ships Cape Coast and Kingston, was involved in selling 631 Africans to plantations in South Carolina. Kruger argued in Parliament against the immediate freedom of all slaves, claiming this should be done gradually and all slave owners compensated. He later left Britain and returned to the United States, where he became a senator. Turning back down Park Street, pause outside number 43, now a modern music store. This was the site of the School for Young Ladies, which Hannah Moore, anti-slavery campaigner, playwright and religious writer, ran with her sisters. Hannah was a friend of William Wilberforce and Thomas Clarkson, leaders of the campaign to abolish slavery, and spoke out openly against the slave trade. In 1778, she joined a major boycott of West Indian sugar, one of the first political campaigns involving women. She denounced Christians involved in the slave trade, stating, "They are not Christians who infest Africa's shores, but are rather white savages ruled by gold or lust of conquest." Walk further down Park Street and cross to the other side of the road, using the pedestrian crossing outside the council house. Once over the road, walk down Unity Street opposite, then across into Orchard Street, which follows on from it. Part 2. James MacTaggart, sometime captain of the slave ship Africa, built a house in this elegant street, which dates from 1717. The West Indian merchant, Mark Davies, also had his offices here. Number 10 Orchard Street stands on the site of the chapel built by the French Protestant refugees known as Huguenots. At least two of the wealthier Huguenots, James La Roche and Louis Casamajor, became prominent slave traders. Their Huguenot friend, Stephen Poloquin, one of the five wealthiest Bristolians in the 18th century, derived money from the tobacco trade, which also depended in large part on slave labour. Poloquin left his fortune to his daughter Marianne, who was, however, noted for her philanthropy. During her lifetime, she lent her house in Queen Square to Josiah Tucker, an ally of the abolitionists. From Orchard Street, turn down Denmark Street and proceed about 180 metres to St. Augustine's Parade on the main centre promenade. Turn left and walk along to the Horn and Trumpet pub just past the Hippodrome Theatre. Look up at the figurehead on the front of the building. This is a smaller version of the figure from the Victorian paddle steamer Demerara that became stranded in the River Avon in 1851. The figure is a romantic personification of the British sugar colony of Demerara in Guyana, which in 1823 was the scene of a bloody revolt involving almost all of the island's 12,000 slaves. Continue down St. Augustine's Parade. Up to the left, when you reach the traffic lights, you'll see the Colston Hall, Bristol's concert hall. This stands on the site of the Great House, a Tudor mansion converted in 1653 into Bristol's first sugar refining house. Plantations in Nevis, Montserrat and Barbados, many owned by Bristol merchants, supplied the refinery. Crossing by the signalled pedestrian crossings, continue walking along this side of the centre promenade. Across the centre, through the trees, you will see St. Stephen's Church. Josiah Tucker, at one time rector here, became Dean of Gloucester and helped Thomas Clarkson with his early investigations into the slave trade. Notice too the statue of Edward Colston standing on the centre, a figure who, over the years, has attracted much controversy. He was a member of the Court of Assistance to the Royal Africa Company, which had official monopoly on the slave trade until 1698. He was also a prominent sugar merchant with interests in the Caribbean island of St. Kitts. However, he endowed many of the city's educational institutions, as well as almshouses and hospitals, and restored a number of churches. Four charitable institutions still exist that were set up in his name: the Colston, Anchor, Grateful, and Dolphin Societies. Walking further on, after 200 metres you enter a covered way called Centre Gate. Then just round the corner you pass the Three Sugar Loaves pub. This gets its name from a sugar refinery nearby, later destroyed by fire. Fire was a big hazard of the sugar refinery process and led to merchants setting up their own insurance firms, such as the Bristol Fire Office in 1718. Continue walking straight on, passing the medieval entrance to St. Bartholomew's. And a few yards further on your left, you will see the Hotel du Vin. This building was once an important sugar house, used to store and process imported sugar. By the 18th century, sugar had gone from being a luxury item to one in high demand. This in turn increased the need for more African slaves to intensify sugar cultivation in the English Caribbean. It was said that the rule was one slave for every acre of sugar. By the second half of the 18th century, Bristol was specialising in the refining of sugar cane, and by 1760 had 20 refineries. Many sugar merchants, such as the Codringtons and Popes, owned large estates around the Bristol area. Part 3. Cross the road by the signalled pedestrian crossings to the other side. Turn right, and then immediately left into Christmas Street. Walk up to St. John's on the Walls, a medieval church with three archways and a small spire. Go through the arch and walk up Broad Street. The Guildhall that once stood in this street was the venue for the first open meeting in Bristol on the abolition of the slave trade in 1788. A petition was drawn up and signed by merchants, councillors and notable clerics, including the Dean of Bristol. Just past number 44, turn left down a small alley into Taylor's Court. At the end of the court on the right-hand side is Court House, the residence of William Miller, a founder member of a company of merchants trading in Africa. He died in 1781, leaving £190,000, again a huge sum. At the top of Broad Street, turn right into Corn Street. The trade in Africans and the commodities it produced meant more money came to Bristol. This money had to be administered. Loans were needed. Slaving and cargo ships had to be insured, as did the sugar refineries and warehouses. Financial services were thus stimulated by the success of the triangular trade. And by the mid-18th century, Corn Street was a focus for banks, insurance offices and coffee houses. It was often in the coffee houses themselves that goods were sold informally, and where merchants would gather to see in the local newspapers what goods were for sale. Goods often included people. On the 12th of January 1754, an advertisement in the Bristol Intelligencer announced, "For sale to any gentleman or lady who wants a Negro boy, a lad of 14 years, recently landed." Walk down Corn Street until you reach the Commercial Rooms, now a pub. They were built in 1810, 3 years after the abolition of the trade. But the building demonstrates the wealth and importance of this area during the 18th and 19th centuries. The three statues represent Bristol, commerce, and navigation, and are sometimes referred to as the Three Graces. A carved relief within the portico shows Britannia checking the monies due to her from the rest of the world. Cross the road to the National Westminster Bank. You can see a plaque on the wall commemorating the old bank, originally set up in Broad Street in 1750. This was one of the banks that eventually merged into the NatWest. All but one of the bank's founders were traders to Africa, demonstrating that there was a clear connection between the slave trade and the development of the banking system in Britain. Walk back up Corn Street on the right-hand side until you come to the Corn Exchange, now known as St Nicholas Market. This was built in 1753, replacing less grand facilities on the site. Despite its name, it was intended for merchants of all types, and a number directly involved in the Guinea and West Indian trade used it for business transactions. However, it seems that most of the merchants dealing in African and American goods preferred the more informal atmosphere of the nearby coffee houses. Look inside the main hall and note the plasterwork above the three main doors. These represent Asia, Africa, and America. The female figure of America wearing a headdress of tobacco leaves. On the outside of the building there are also carvings of African, American, Asian and European figures and animals. Again, symbols of Bristol's foreign trade. Leaving the Corn Exchange by the way you came in, you will see the four nails, flat-topped pillars where money was exchanged. These gave their name to the expression, paying on the nail. All Saints Church on the corner of Corn Street is now an education and resource centre for the Bristol Diocese and may be viewed on request. It contains the tomb of Edward Colston, the Bristol merchant and philanthropist referred to earlier. It is an impressive edifice, designed and sculpted by Michael Rees-Brack. Colston helped to fund the restoration of the Tower of All Saints in 1716. Part 4. From All Saints Church, carry on to the top of Corn Street, then turn right down High Street and walk down towards Bristol Bridge. Cross Baldwin Street by St Nicholas Church at the signalled pedestrian crossing. Then, walking away from Bristol Bridge, proceed along Welsh Back with the river on the left, passing in front of the Mercure Brigstow Hotel. When you arrive at the top of King Street, turn right. King Street was built in the 17th century. and retain several buildings that owe their existence to the wealth generated by the slave trade. In 1775, the street was home to both Henry Webb, captain of the slaver Nevis Planter, and Robert Walls, surgeon on the slave ship Guinea. Halfway down the street on the right, you will see the imposing facade of Cooper's Hall, now the foyer building of the Bristol Old Vic. The Theatre Royal, the main house, is the oldest working theatre in the country. It was opened in 1766 and was paid for by 50 wealthy people in the city, many of them merchants, each investing £50. Patrons included the Farr family, Henry Bright and Michael Miller, who all lived in Queen Square and were participants in the African trade. Another patron, George Daubeny, was a sugar refiner and glass manufacturer who lobbied for abolition of the slave trade, then changed his mind and joined the city's anti-abolitionist committee in 1789. Proceed to the end of the street and you will see the merchants' almshouses on the right. Rebuilt by the Society of Merchant Venturers in 1696, the almshouse was intended for convalescent and old sailors to see out their days. The modern building just beyond the almshouse stands on the site of the old Merchants' Hall and is named Venturers' House. The original hall was destroyed in the Second World War, and the present Merchants' Hall is in Clifton. In 1552, the merchants in Bristol obtained a royal charter which established them as the Merchant Venturers of the City of Bristol, which sought exclusive control of foreign trade. The Merchant Venturers were a powerful lobby, responsible in the 18th century for ensuring Bristol had its share of the slave and commodities trade in Africa. They defended the trade on the grounds that the city's prosperity depended on it. The Society of Merchant Venturers have donated their records to the city, and they are kept at the city's record office. At the bottom of King Street, Marsh Street stretches to the right. This was once a rough area near to the quayside, the haunt of seafarers and, by the 18th century, of poor Irish immigrants. The anti-slavery campaigner Thomas Clarkson wrote in 1808 that Bristol slave masters used to pick up their crew in the mainly Irish-owned taverns here, which were notorious for their music, dancing, rioting, drunkenness and profane swearing. There are said to have been some 37 taverns on this street alone. Part 5. Return to the end of King Street, cross the road and walk over to the corner of Queen Square. Queen Square was completed in 1727, when Bristol's involvement with the slave trade was nearing its height. The square is a reminder of the genteel lifestyle of Bristol's merchants that was made possible by the wealth of the Atlantic trade, much of which involved trading in slaves and slave-produced commodities. Less than a third of the original buildings remain, however, mainly owing to damage caused by the Bristol Reform Bill riots of 1831, and the bombing of the Second World War. In 1775, seven Africa merchants, one West India merchant, and a firm of Virginia tobacco merchants were based here. During the 1831 riots, a black servant of the pro-slavery activist and Queen Square resident Christopher Claxton refused to join the rioters and was said to have thrown some of them out of the window of his master's house. By the early 19th century, merchants had left the square for the healthier district of Clifton, away from the smells of the river and the threat of flooding. Proceed along the north side of the square to your left until you come to the Custom House. Originally built on Welsh Back, the Custom House was moved in 1711 to a specially built house here in Queen Square. The function of the Custom House was to oversee the trade of the port and derive duties and other revenues from the ships leaving and coming to Bristol, including those ships involved in the African trade. The present Custom House was built after the riots of 1831. Cross the square via Rhys Brack's imposing equestrian statue of William III and make your way across to number 37, which was the site of the first American consulate in Britain, established in 1792. Between 1698 and 1807, about 2,100 slaving ventures sailed from Bristol. Trade with Africa, the West Indies and America accounted for more than three-fifths of Bristol's commerce in the 18th century. After American independence, Bristol continued to trade with both the northern states and the southern slave states, which accounts for the establishment of a consulate in Bristol. Exports of largely slave-produced tobacco from the southern states featured prominently in the city's economy. Move along left to numbers 33 to 35, now a modern building. A plaque here commemorates Captain Woodes Rogers, who died in 1732 and was an early resident of the square. He was Bristol's most famous privateer, celebrated for his voyage around the world from 1708 to 1711. Woodes Rogers had many investments, including the slaver Whetstone Galley, which in 1708 took 270 African slaves to Jamaica. His privateering exploits helped to secure the Caribbean against the Spanish. In 1717, at his own suggestion, he was rewarded for his efforts with the governorship of the Bahamas. Again, continue along this side of the square until you reach number 29. Now the regional headquarters of English Heritage, this is the best preserved of the original buildings, as shown by its forecourt gates and railings and its internal panelling and staircase. The house was built in 1709 for Alderman Nathaniel Day, who became Bristol's mayor in 1737. Day petitioned against a proposed tax on slaves. By mid-century, number 29 was the home of Henry Bright, a prominent merchant venturer and slave trader. On his death in 1771, he left an annuity of £10 per annum, chargeable on the house where I now dwell, to my black servant, Bristol. Continue until you leave the square and see the hole-in-the-wall pub on your right. Once called the Coach and Horses, the hole-in-the-wall pub is a well-known Bristol landmark. In the 18th century, it was one of a number of pubs frequented by seafarers in the age of press gangs, when men were kidnapped during wartime and forcibly recruited into serving in the British Navy. The spy house, on the dock side of the pub, was reputedly used to watch out for press gangs and government agents searching for smugglers. Although press gangs were not used for slave ships, underhand methods were often employed to get sailors aboard. Slave ships were not popular with sailors because of the high mortality rates and the danger of slave rebellions. It was common in many of the taverns around the centre of Bristol for landlords to receive money from shipowners in return for plying sailors with drink to get them in debt. The only way the sailors could then avoid going to the poorhouse or debtor's prison was to enlist on a slave ship. Part 6. Taking care to cross the road at the roundabout, continue over Redcliffe Bridge, using the path on the right-hand side. Once over the bridge, continue on the footpath as it bends to the right at the second roundabout, and note the small green area to your right. This is the Quakers' burial ground. As a close-knit religious group, Quakers usually married amongst themselves and engaged in business ventures together. As a result, a complex international network of family, banking and business partnerships spanned Britain, Ireland, America and the Caribbean in the 18th century. In the late 17th and early 18th centuries, Bristol Quakers, such as Charles and John Scandrett, were slave ship owners. Famous Quakers who benefited from the produce of colonial slave labour included Fry's, cocoa, and Lloyd's and Barclays, banking and insurance, and the Galtons, guns. Other families, less well known today but leading Bristol merchants of the period, included the Champions, the Goldneys and the Harfords, whose brass and iron goods were traded to West Africa for slaves. In the 1760s, however, Quakers were the first religious body to oppose the slave trade. Quaker women were particularly active in this campaign. By the 1780s, the Quakers were at the forefront of the abolitionist movement and went on to make an important contribution to the emancipation movement of the early 19th century. To your left, across the road, you can see St. Mary Redcliffe's church. A local story has it that this famous church held slaves in the caves below before they were sold, but there's no written evidence for this. However, it was reported that when William Wilberforce's first bill to abolish the slave trade was defeated in Parliament in 1791, the bells of St. Mary Redcliffe were rung amid general civic celebrations. Turn right, taking the sloping footpath, and climb the short hill to Redcliffe Parade. This is a fine row of 18th century houses with views across the docks. Ship owner Thomas King's family lived in one of these houses. The goods he traded directly with Africa included palm oil, ivory, and redwood. King and shipbuilder and merchant Sydenham Teist owned a number of ships, including the African Queen. Unlike Teist, King does not appear to have traded in slaves. Take the steep ramp down onto the wharf below. At the bottom of the ramp, to your left, you can see one of the entrances to Redcliffe Caves set into the cliff. There is a local tradition that slaves were incarcerated in these caves. See the plaque above one of the entrances. This story may have originated because goods related to the African and West Indian trades were stored there. The only other evidence linking the caves with the slave trade is an 18th century account of French seamen, some of whom may have been black, being taken prisoner by Bristol privateers and kept in the caves. The main product of the caves was sand, needed for the production of glass for bottling spirits, such as rum, made from molasses, another product of slave-produced sugar, and for other glass objects, including trade goods for Africa. This area, Temple Gate and St. Philip's, were the main centres of glass production in Bristol. Glasshouse owners included John Cave and George Daubeny. Walk on to the end of the wharf, then turn left, where you will find the Ostrich Pub. Dating back to at least 1745, the pub contains an interesting account of its history and of the port of Bristol at the time. One of its walls has been partly demolished to reveal the interior of one of the many caves under Redcliffe. On the wall opposite is a copy of a trade card for the pub, dated 1775, which features a young black man, possibly a slave. Sitting enjoying a drink outside this pub, it is not hard to imagine the bustling port that gave Bristol such a dynamic economy. But we also need to remember how much of that wealth was earned by importing goods produced on the other side of the world by slave labour. That is the end of the slave trade trail. We hope you've enjoyed this walk. You may like to know that other downloadable trails around Bristol are available on www.visitbristol.co.uk.
This podcast is based on the Bristol Slave Trade Trail, written by Madge Dresser, Coletta Jordan and Doreen Taylor, and published by Bristol's Museums, Galleries and Archives. It was produced by The Pod Factory Limited on behalf of Destination Bristol.